As we said earlier on in the show, I was so fortunate our good friend Joel Morrow had invited me down to his lovely place here outside of Bay City for the first ever hunt for two of General Chuck Yeager's grandchildren. And, of course, we're always pushing involve the family in the outdoors on our program. It's a great opportunity to be here with these young people who are having a wonderful time, and of course a great opportunity to be here with the General, and I must say it is a pleasure to have you take your time out from the family to do the show today, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Harold. You know, Joel and I have been talking about this for about 3 years, and my grandson is now 14 and my granddaughter is 12, so when they were obviously 3 years younger, we started talking about, he said, bring them down to my ranch and they can shoot their first deer there. So they both got them a couple 243s. Old Kenny Jarrett down in North South Carolina built one for Susie, my granddaughter, or Amanda, my granddaughter. And then Cody had a Model 7 Remington. And they both are very, very good shots. And I, lo and behold, last night Joel and I had them out, and Cody shot his... he shot an 8-point buck, and then this morning we're out there with Amanda, and man, she plows down on another 8-pointer, and they got their first deer. And it was really fun for me because I've hunted ever since I was about 6 years old, and to see the expression on kids' face when they make a good successful shot and harvest some game, and they helped you know, skin them and cut them up and everything. So it was really a pleasure to see.
Well, these are really great kids. Of course, I want to take both their rifles because they fit me. But Amanda's, it's a 243 Ackley Improved that Kenny Jarrett built for her, and boy, is it beautiful.
Oh, I bet it sound like a great firearm. General Yeager, I've got to ask you, you said you started hunting 6 years old. What was the response of your granddaughter when she got her buck? It seems like it's ingrained.
Obviously, right. Bill, and she just, all she did was when we spotted these two bucks, they were sort of sparring, and I opened my front door. She got out of the back and come up and leaned against the door, and it was about 150 yards away, and she nailed it right through the middle, and it was a good shot. And of course, she's shot paper targets, but never anything alive, and she understands shooting well enough to she picks a spot, and she usually hits it.
By the way, I'll interject here. We are on private property. We're not road hunting.
Right. Exactly.
Make sure my notes that was proper. But it was very interesting. Yesterday evening, the general wanted to show me something, and he opened up Amanda's gun case and showed me her first target. First time ever with this rifle. Three shots, 100 yards, one hole.
Ooh.
Yes. You know, it was quite exciting.
It's often been said that women shoot better than men.
Is where you grew up, right?
West Virginia, big difference.
But, get it right.
Yeah, I was raised there, and we hunted mainly for a food source, and you know, black bear and rabbits and squirrel and deer. And I left there in 1941 when I was 18, went into military service, and spent the rest of my life there. But hunting was a way of life with all of us, and we were, you know, it was amazing to me to see how the old farmers were really conservationists. They were good game managers, and they never over-harvested and things like that. So.
So you didn't need the government to tell you how to do that.
No, you're right about that.
Earlier somebody was asking you something like, have you ever shot a black bear? And you said, how many before you were 18?
I said, yeah, I killed 44 before I was 18 because Mom canned them all. She ground them up and canned them. And they're a good source of food, and they were thick up there in the mountains of West Virginia.
Yeah. Bill?
Oh, well, General, everybody should be familiar with your rich military service history and records that you have had. And I was wondering if it was the West Virginia background that took you in that direction as compared to, say, kids of today feeling that it's appropriate to go into the military and serve their time, protecting our country.
Well, back in 41, when we finished high school,
and you were dealing with the war.
Arming and right. Mobilizing.
Right.
And it just was a thing to do. And when I first got into service, I just looked at it as this is an opportunity for me to honor my flag and my country. And that's the way we felt. And I had never even seen an airplane on the ground until I got in the Army Air Corps. So I knew nothing about flying, but the Air Force taught me everything I needed to know. And obviously I had to had good hand-eye coordination and good stamina, and so I made a very good fighter pilot and later on a test pilot. And it was interesting to me. You know, people were very loyal and dedicated back when I was younger. And I think it's probably difficult for youngsters to understand really what duty means to your country, especially because there's so much other things to do today, and you get so many tree huggers and people like that in the act who hate hunting and things like that. And it's really unfortunate that the youngsters today, and that's the reason I was happy to see my grandkids all hunt and they all fish, and they really enjoy the outdoors.
Now, this is only two of how many grandchildren, too?
I got 13, so, and they all hunt. So. And these are the youngest, Harold. So.
Well, that's a good upbringing. I've got to, a bit before we get into our break, ask you, back in the career, it's kind of a three-part question, actually. What qualities did you find that made for a good combat pilot? Not just yourself, but other men.
Well, I think one of the things that came out of World War II, I was a Mustang pilot flying against the Germans. I shot down some 13 Germans and got shot down myself. But the one thing that came out of the war in Europe especially was that 11% of all the fighter pilots involved in combat shot down 90% of the airplanes. You know, that's a big discrepancy. You say, why? What happened to the other 79%? But if you go back and look at the background of all these guys who were highly successful fighter pilots, was they were all raised as rural kids, understood deflection shooting, were aggressive, and had a lot of stamina. And that's basically the thing that came out of it. And guys who had good eyesight, good hand-eye coordination, and understood deflection shooting were very successful. Now, that wouldn't work today because everything we have developed is computer-enhanced, and it's all done for you. So it just takes a good, smart kid that makes good grades who will be successful as a fighter pilot today. So.
Well, he better have some moxie, too, though, shouldn't he?
He's got to be aggressive and all that stuff.
Okay, now what did you find later on, qualities then that made good test pilots?
Well, basically, I think I was disciplined in combat, so doing test work, you got to concentrate on what you're doing and forget about the outcome. And that's basically, I was disciplined enough in combat and trained that way. And also, I was raised as a mechanic by my father, so I understood machinery, and I knew when an airplane was getting close to the ragged edge and knew to back off. And that, and also to be at the right place at the right time. That luck plays a big role in your life.
Well, as you said, to dispel a lot of the thoughts that one might have, because you're out there testing somebody else's equipment, and you get the tail end of something when it goes wrong.
Well, you're the one that's sitting there in the cockpit, and if things fall apart on you, you better revert to your egress system or your survival equipment, like ejection seats and or pressure suits and parachutes and things like that. No, basically, today, with simulation and computer enhancement, it's a lot easier. In the old days, it was trial and error, and we killed a lot of guys before the space program developing systems. But today, it's relatively safe, and fortunately, that's the way it should be.
Well, those of us that love planes are certainly impressed by, you know, the breaking of the sound barrier, but what made that one incident that important in aviation itself, breaking that mark?
Well, Harold, basically we were hamstrung. See, we're limited up to about 0.8 Mach number until we got the X-1 and a rocket, and we're able to thrust it right on after the speed of sound. But the big thing that came out of the X-1 program was we lost the elevator effectiveness, and we had to revert to flying the airplane with a trimmable horizontal stabilizer. And that was a big thing that came out of the X-1 program. We found out that you needed a flying tail to control the airplane through Mach 1. And it was amusing to me. It took the British and the French and the Soviet Union 5 years to find out that little trick that we found out with the X-1. It gave us a quantum jump over the rest of the world in aerodynamics. So.
And you didn't share it?
Well, of course not. That's where it's supposed to be.
All right, Bill.
I got one quick question for you, General. Before we head into our next break, it's about a minute away. Why weren't you one of the original seven? You mentioned the astronaut program.
Well, basically, when the space program started in 1959, the requirement to get in it, you had to have a degree, and I only had a high school education, and so I had no interest at all. In fact, you might be interested to know that I was commandant of the astronaut school at Edwards. I trained 27 of the guys. that went into space in the Mercury, Gemini, or the Apollo and the shuttle program. And like guys like Frank Borman, Jim McDivitt, Tom Stafford, and people like that were on my staff in the school. So we did a lot of work for NASA. In fact, they were the outstanding guys in NASA. But the reason I wasn't, and I didn't even give it a second thought, I didn't have the education, and that was a requirement, and so I didn't even give it a second thought.
I see. Well, it shows that education can come from varied sources, right?
Goes to show you. I'll tell you what.
All right.
Okay, is it about break time,
Bill? It is break time. Why don't you take us out, Harold?
Okay, I will do that. You have listened to the first half of Texas Outdoor News, but don't go away because we've got a lot more, and General Chuck Yeager will be with us in the second half of the show. We'll be back right after this.
Our guest today is General Chuck Yeager, and before the break, we were visiting with him a little bit about the astronaut corps and the reasons why he had not pursued that. But I want to get back to talking hunting with you, General, if I can. In fact, we've got a mutual friend as an outfitter that I know you've hunted with, and that's George Tallman, United States Outfitters out of Taos, New Mexico.
Yeah, I've known George a long time, and in fact, he had a kid named Jerry Van Diver used to guide for him, and I loved to hunt with those. Those guys hunted up there in the Chama Land Cattle Company area, and I knew all of the Indians up there used to give them rides in airplanes.
Well, having hunted in the high country, growing up in West Virginia, is there a particular type of hunting, big game hunting, small game, bird hunting that you prefer, or do you just like to be out in the outdoors?
Well, I just like to be out in the outdoors, but, you know, when it comes right down to it, probably elk hunting is my favorite. You don't get a lot of exercise. It's hard work when you shoot something. Next would be quail hunting. I love to quail hunt, and basically not planted birds, but, you know, wild birds with dogs. And I love hunting blue quail out in West Texas. Marfa, I got a friend out there. And, of course, down here, deer hunting and seeing the kids, as we discussed earlier, Joel and I talked about this about 3 years ago, coming down here on his ranch. So Joel Morrow, who makes miniature guns, he gave my granddaughter a little Model 94 Winchester 3030, you know, about 18 inches long, and she fell in love with it, and him, and of course they generated a friendship, and he invited the kids down, and I brought them down the day after Christmas, and they both have killed their deer, the Cody last night and Amanda this morning, so it turned out real good.
That's great. You think they're both now hooked on hunting for life?
Well, I'm sure they will. You know, they but all kids grow up, have families, and they teach your kids to hunt or fish primarily, and I think fishing is as important as hunting, you know, and basically it's being outdoors, and also one thing I got to get a plug in way is the professional wildlife managers in every state that I've hunted in really do an outstanding job, and it's unfortunate when the damn politicians, if you pardon the expression, get involved in wildlife management, because they can't do it. It takes the professional guys, and they do a wonderful job.
Well, we've certainly seen that. You touched on fishing, and one of the things here in Texas that we're obviously having to deal with is what many perceive as the mismanagement of the red snapper fishery offshore. Congress passed a law mandating certain quotas, and there's no substantiation of how that total allowable catch is calculated, and they're trying to manage the entire Gulf of Mexico as one entity, and everyone knows that what's off the Florida coast is entirely different to what we have off the Texas coast. So I appreciate your comment there of getting the politicians out of the way and let the professional biologist do their work. Back to quail hunting, you said that that's kind of your second or most favorite sport. As you travel around the country, where are you still finding some good populations of quail? Obviously in Texas,
well,
our drought has been
here in Texas, right? You've had about 2 to 3 years of very bad hatches because of drought.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I found that regardless of what state you hunt birds in, it cycles about every 11 years. You peak out, and then for 11 it goes down, and it bottoms out and peaks out again, and that's true in most every state, like in California where we hunt gamble or valley quail, and in West Texas the blues, in my opinion, have suffered much less than the bobwhite quail have in Texas or in central and southern Texas. But basically it's a cycle, and it just takes good management, and you've got to know what you're doing.
That's true on that 11-year cycle. It's something we've seen here in Texas. Going to take you down the road to firearms. As a hunter, sometimes we become really infatuated with a particular caliber or a particular firearm or a need to maybe try some new wildcat. Any caliber preferences for your big game hunting or general hunting?
Well, basically, I shoot a 7mm Remington mag, and the reason I do is I hand load for all of the calibers I have. I have a Weatherby, but I never hunt with it. And I my favorite is I load a 160 grain Spear Grand Slam in my 7mm mag, and that does a beautiful job on elk. I drop down to a 120 grain, primarily a nozzler ballistic tip for deer and antelope, and that pretty well covers whatever I need to hunt. If I go for, you know, grizzlies or bear, I'm not a big game hunter from Africa. I usually I'll drop up to my 300 Weatherby for bears or something that large, because that 180 grain is a little heavier bullet than that 160 in my 7mm.
You probably grew up doing a lot of small game hunting, and what we've seen here in Texas with this new generation of hunters coming along and with the popularity of deer hunting is many kids are making that big step to big game hunting before they've really satisfied that small game urge with squirrels and rabbits. How about your children and grandchildren? Do you still have a chance to get out and do some small game hunting with them?
Yeah, probably. We shoot, you know, varmints with like a 22-250 or 223, and they, you know, most kids today kind of bypass small game hunting because squirrels, according to some states, just it isn't popular to hunt squirrels or rabbits. And but back in the mountains, rabbits were good eating, and so were squirrels. And most kids today sort of bypass the smaller game and go around and into deer hunting or elk or bear or things like that.
Harold, I know that that you're one that loves the small game hunting.
Maybe. Well, I do, and I was raised doing that. Of course, you know me. Give me an empty Coke can and a .22, and I'm happy because I just love to plink. In talking to the general over the last couple of days of being here, he hunts, by the way, we're talking about elk, with our good friend Jim Zumbo. And I was mentioning to him when we had Jim on the show earlier this year talking about the possible reintroduction of the Mexican wolves to Texas, about what had been happening in his part of the country. And I think the general agrees that's another thing where we need to leave it to the wildlife managers and the biologists to know what they're doing, not the federal government.
Absolutely. Absolutely, for sure. Because from everything that I heard from Zumbo and the folks coming out of Canada is that wolves are very indiscriminate killers, and if you don't manage them as a specific species, you're going to miss the boat. You can't protect them forever. What else y'all doing up there? Yes, what else are you doing up there, Harold?
Eating mainly. Joel Morrow's going to get ready to cook up some steaks. We've been gorging every day and night. And it's really wonderful to get down here, and we top everything off with pralines every night, you know.
Yeah, you'll end up putting on some weight like I did. And I tell you what, that's some great, great fun in deer camp. Go ahead, Harold.
Okay, the wolf thing, though. General, weren't you mentioning about a sheep kill that you had witnessed with wolves?
Yeah, I was on the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation board under President Bush for 4 years. And you know, basically one of the big things that came into it, like I was hunting sheep up in the Dall Ranch, and I ran into 26 Dall ewes that about, I don't know, half a dozen wolves had killed indiscriminately. And they're professional killers. They're good at it. And what's coming, like in Yellowstone, they're pretty well wiping out the elk calf crop. And unfortunately, probably in 10 years there's going to be very few elk up in that country, and then they'll spread out into the cattle and the ranchers will control them again.
Well, that is unfortunate, and obviously we are going to learn a lesson the hard way. Once again,
yeah, and like I said, General, being a witness of that, because none of those ewes were eaten.
Sure.
And by the way, it's only fair to mention our host, because he came in here in the room we're in, kicked his shoes off, and he's monitoring us. Say hi, Joel. Yep, there he is, Mr. Personality.
Very good.
We call him Uncle Joel here.
Harold, we're up against a break. Why don't you take us to it?
I will do it. Again, our guest today has been General Chuck Yeager. It's been quite an honor here from the Morrow Ranch outside Bay City, Texas. We'll be taking a break, and after we finish the show, I'm looking forward to whatever Joel's cooking up outside. But, General, again, we appreciate you taking the time out of your hunt with your grandchildren to share some of that involvement of getting the kids and getting the family involved in hunting. We appreciate you taking time to share it with us.
Thank you very much, Harold. It's been a pleasure.